Hello and welcome to the Nature Garden podcast with me, Carl Steinson, and the weekending show team from Lionheart Radio. It's a chance to take a wander down the garden path and country lane with the birds and the bees and the flowers and trees, and it's an opportunity to hear stories from the past and present. In this episode, Tom Pattinson on the joys of greenhouse gardening. We're down in the grounds of Cresswell Peel Tower with Steve Lowe from the Northumberland Rivers Trust. Tom Cadwallander from the British Trust for Ornithology is excited about an albatross-related visitor from afar. Plus some top tips for the garden from Tom P. All coming up on the Nature Garden Podcast. Warm sunshine this month has been fab for flowers and for gardeners. Greenhouse spaces, big or small, can bring the benefits of warmth and shelter all year round. Here's Tom Pattinson to tell us more.
There's no denying that having a greenhouse really gives you another dimension in the garden. Inside there you can grow a range of plants that would otherwise struggle to survive outdoors. That's edible crops and ornamental crops. Mine also, next to this last week, Monday and Tuesday, were really wet days. The garden was completely out of bounds. I'd just have made a mess if I'd gone onto the borders or the vegetable plot. But the greenhouse wasn't. It was welcoming. And there were jobs to be done in there. Potting up. Taking some cuttings which had been stood in water overnight, and that sort of thing. Lots of things to do in the greenhouse. It was sort of a place to find refuge for the day. Amazing. Greenhouses can have this effect. They can also be a sort of a hospital for plants, where a plant can gain respite and rediscover its balance, find its mojo. If there's a plant in the house that's been overwatered, say, if they're over too dry or too wet at the roots, they will droop their leaves. So I'm a bit zealous with watering occasionally, so I find the culprit. I take it into the greenhouse, that potted plant. I knock it from the pot. I stand it on the bench, on a slate on the bench, and leave it there until it dries out. No water, no pot surrounding it, just the plug surrounding the roots that came from the pot. And quite often this helps them survive, and it can go back, be rehabilitated in the house. It's quite a useful item for that. If you're going to get a greenhouse, when you're thinking about it, there'll be advice coming out of your ears. Everybody wants to tell you which one to get and how much to spend. And the general advice is, think of the size you want, think of the size you can afford, and double both those figures. This is because you start off possibly with an aluminium greenhouse, which is cheaper in the long run than the timber-based ones, but very effective. This is what I started with, one that was 4 foot wide and 6 feet long. And before I knew it, it was full of plants, and I wanted something bigger. So buy the biggest you can afford, if there's a space for it in the garden. Generally, south-facing is brilliant, or east or west facing, so getting some sun during the day, and sight it, and then think about what's going to go inside. I will need staging for displays, that's the benches that the ornamental plants stand on, and I also would like a border that I can grow crops in. So those are my two priorities: get some staging or benching up to support the plants, show them off to their best, and put something in the border, something that's going to be used in the kitchen perhaps, but it could be ornamental, of course. Heating is something to think about Is it going to be a cold greenhouse, by which I mean no artificial heat, just the natural warmth effect of the sun, so-called greenhouse effect, warming it up during the day? Or is it going to be artificial, say electric or gas, a gas canister, oil burner? Some people on allotments still have coal burner there, and they fill it with sea coal. Whatever, make a decision on whether you're going to heat it or not, whether you can afford the cost of that, and go for it. Ventilation is an important thing as well. There'll be at least one, maybe two or three, just depending on the size of the greenhouse, vents, open windows at the top, to let air in, a flow of air. There must be a flow of air. Still air conditions encourage diseases, fungal diseases like mildew. So I love a flow of air through, and I have artificial ventilators, automatic, I should say, ventilators. And those ventilators open themselves and close themselves. They have a piston attachment which has mineral oil in. And as it warms up, it expands, pushes the light up the window. And as it gets cool, it contracts and closes the window. Straightforward stuff. And that's useful if you're not going to hurry up in the morning, having to lie in. There must be a potting bench somewhere, surely. You need to do your potting on, potting up, etc. And maybe a propagating unit, so you can propagate your own plants and save money in the long run. Those are the basics in my greenhouse. A few minutes, I'll tell you what's in it, what's growing.
There are over 600 species of birds on what is known as the British List, but now and then surprise new entries fly into view, and Tom Cadwallader from the British Trust for Ornithology has had an exciting week thanks to a species of seabird related to the albatross.
There are about 10,500 species of birds to be found in the world. That list is actually growing as well. It's either through taxonomic changes, you know, scientists are actually discovering more about birds, they're through DNA, and they're finding sort of birds which are closely related, actually are separate species. Sometimes birds have been rediscovered, or sometimes even birds have been discovered in the kind of the rainforests, for example, of South America or Southeast Asia. So you think, actually, it's a constantly changing thing, which is absolutely fascinating. And in the UK, we've got 626 species currently on the British List. And again, it's the same sort of idea that the list will change through taxonomic changes, and indeed new species will be found in the country, usually through vagrancy or some such. But little did I know last week that I would be party to a potential new species to the British List. How exciting is that? Fantastic. And it's a species of seabird. You know, at this time of year, we get quite excited to be bird watchers because the things are starting to change on the sea. Birds are starting to travel, particularly when the wind comes out the north. It becomes quite exciting. And there are kind of the diehards will get down to the shore and look out to sea and see what we can see. And we'll see shearwaters, we'll see petrels, we'll see skuas, we'll see all sorts of things. And currently there is a black-browed albatross, which is a bird of the southern oceans, currently on the Bempton Cliffs in North Yorkshire, which has caused a huge amount of excitement in the ornithological world, because albatrosses are not found in the northern hemisphere generally. There's just the odd bird will get across the equator and be found sort of lurking around, and when they do cross the equator, they tend to stay quite a long time. But that's not the species in question. What I'm thinking of is the species which is related to albatrosses, and it's a petrel. But anyway, let's not get ahead of myself here. Last Thursday, there was a call came in from some sea watchers down in Flamborough saying that we've got this strange petrel, which is a seabird, tube nose like the albatross and like the fulmar that we have, and this tube nose arrangement they have on their on the top of their bill allows them to drink seawater and to spend so much time out at sea. But anyway, the call came through is this strange petrel was coming up, and keep an eye out for it. So as the day progressed, this bird was seen travelling north at various points. It was seen at Flamborough. Then it was seen one or two other places, Long Nab near Scarborough. And then it was picked up at Whitburn in County Durham. And then we Northumbrian birdwatchers were getting quite excited about this. So we all piled down the coast. Then it was picked up at Cullinose. And this bird was flying really quite low, perhaps about 1.5 kilometres offshore, flying low. And they fly in a quite a distinctive way. They have a kind of a they'll use the dynamic sort of wave action. They'll fly and get the energy off the sea and bank and fly back again. They have this sort of castellation sort of flight pattern. So this bird was coming up and we were getting quite excited about this. And it was seen at Cullinose. Then it was picked up by one person at St Mary's Island and just north of Whitley Bay, and then it was missed at St Mary's at Seton Sluice, and then some guys at Newbiggin Church Point in Newbiggin picked it up and it was passing up, and people were looking at Druids Bay but they missed it, and we're crikey, what's going on here? Anyway, we were watching. I was seven of us watching at Cullinose Point near Howick, just south of Craster. And we picked this bird up coming off the headland, just off Boomer Headland, Longhorton Steel. And we got to see it, and it was really quite low, and it was coming through. And this bird had a grey back. It kind of had a sort of a darker W sort of colour on the back of its wings, not unlike a juvenile kittiwake. But underneath, it was all white. We could see it sort of had a continuous breastband as well, which gave us a clue to its identity. And initially we thought, oh, this is a phase petrel, which kind of lives, spends its time around the Madeira and the Desertus Islands, or it could have been a Desertus petrel. Quite difficult to sort out these birds. But anyway, the fact that we got onto the breastband, it was a continuous breastband. And some people in Newbiggin got some photographs which confirmed this identification feature. And then the word got round on the internet that this bird was through. And you never believe it, that somebody says, hey, hang on a minute, I know what that is. It's a soft plumaged petrel. A petrel which is found only in the Southern Oceans. It gets nowhere near than sort of South Africa. It breeds right down through in Australia. So it's actually, it was travelling through the Northern Hemisphere. It was absolutely incredible. So it was a soft plumaged petrel. So this bird is a first record for Britain. So I was party to this first record for Britain. Soft plumaged petrel. Absolutely fantastic. So there was hooping and hollering of us. There was seven of us at Cullinose Point. It was fantastic. So, you know, you never know what's around the corner, around the ornithological corner. Absolutely fantastic. So I'm still buzzing now. I can't believe it. So, you know, we're in a period of change and just stuff is happening on the sea. And shortly after that, we had a skua come through, which we puzzled over for a little while. And it turned out to be a Pomeranian skua. Not very common at all, but because of the northerly winds, stirred things up. But getting back to the soft plumage petrel, we just didn't expect it to come through, because what happens is they get rooted through the channel. Then the birds will get into the North Sea, just hug the coastline, follow the coastline north, and they'll come out the top end and back into the Atlantic. And hopefully this bird will actually get back down into the Southern Oceans again. But here I am assisting with a new species for the British list. Fantastic. And I'm still kind of in cloud cuckoo land here. It's fantastic. Soft plumage petrel. Brilliant.
Strikes one, the clock strikes two. Busy doing nothing in the afternoon. Clock strikes three, and then four. No one comes knocking at my door anymore. clock strikes five, the clock strikes six. British way of life, it don't exist. Clock strikes seven, and then eight. No handshakes to communicate anymore. Just for man, just in case you've lost your place, there ain't no real government. The clock strikes nine, the clock strikes ten. Here we go with underlying conditions again. The clock strikes 11 and then 12. We can't escape Corona hell anymore. It's the middle of the night, I'm still awake. I'm reading a book on old Tom Waits. It's inspired me enough to write this song, oh, to be singing when Corona's come. 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 Come on, come on, sing along. Oh, to be singing when Corona's come. Come on, come on, sing along. Oh, to be singing when Corona's come. 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 Oh, to be singing when Corona's come.
Oh, to be singing by Shipcoat and Friends from their new album Local Stars, which is being launched in style this week with a live gig. Yes, it's great to hear that they are indeed singing and playing live again. For more details, check out Shipcoat and Friends on Facebook or on the grand thing that's known as the World Wide Web. Tom's taking a look at greenhouses this week, and he's got peaches and all sorts of amazing things in there to inspire us all to give greenhouse gardening a go. Over to you, Tom.
Okay, the greenhouse is up and running. What are you going to grow in it? That's a good question. I've got a couple of permanent fixtures in there, and I'd suggest they're so easy to grow and so rewarding that I'd suggest you consider something like this. The first is a grapevine, but to be precise, two grapevines. One is Madeleine Angevin, a white grape, which has ripened by the end of August and continues giving me bunches of grapes. It's self-fertile until throughout August, the rest of August, into September and way into November. The other vine is Black Hamburg. And this one, it doesn't come on the scene until about mid-September. The fruits are ripe, and they go up to the beginning, into the middle sometimes, of December. Plenty of fresh fruit there. And then it's pruned over winter. Now, when I introduced it, I was concerned about no heating in the greenhouse, the winter period. And I thought about covering it in fleece to give it some protection. Someone said to me, you don't need an experienced gardener, you don't need fleece. This was years ago, and of course I didn't. And this year, the temperature in that greenhouse has been down to -5 Celsius. Some plants were covered with fleece, but not the vine. The other permanent fixture in there is the peach. It's a fertile, self-fertile peach. and it's called Peregrine. Beautiful peaches. It's also, I used some fleece on that the first couple of winters after planting. This was about 10 years ago. And the end of the second, beginning of the third year, in that summer, it gave me my first fruit. And it's never stopped fruiting since. The fruits come online the end of this month, late July, every year. I don't need to touch them. In fact, if you handle the peach fruits too much, they bruise easily. So I just use my nose. I walk into the greenhouse and take a big sniff, as I do anyway, because there are flowers in there as well. And as soon as I go in, ah, one of those peaches is ripe, maybe more than one. And I sniff out the one that's ripe, pick it, and they are delicious. Now, they last throughout July until August, into the mid of August, sometimes to near the end of August, because they don't all ripen at once. I thinned the crop out, and believe it or not, I can get up to probably 70 or 80 peaches. And that is quite something. In a cold greenhouse, unheated greenhouse, those are my two main fixtures. And of course, there are other plants which pass through, they crop for me, etc. And the best example of this, I think, is the greenhouse border. In that greenhouse border, I currently have the tomato crop. They're in pots, and their pots are standing with compost in, and those pots are standing on what I call the substrata, the substrate, which is the soil beneath the in the border. And I'm watering once a week now, because the first truss of tomatoes has formed on each plant. I'm watering the pot area, the compost in the pots, once a week with a general fertilizer. And I water the substrate, the soil below in the border, with water. And there's plenty of water there for those plants, because the fruits need to swell. And to do that, they need, apart from the warmth, they need plenty of moisture. So they're doing well at the moment. Now, when those are finished, I have some early chrysanthemums outdoors in the garden. I also have some late chrysanthemums, which are growing in pots outdoors. Large pots have been transferred into. And when we come to the end of September, going into October, I clear out all of the tomatoes from the border. I clear the border, I give it a general fertilizer, and those pots of the late chrysanthemums will stand on that border. And when they're finished, just about late November into December, it's as late as December sometimes, I clear the border again and I put the leaf lettuce crop in. And it's good, and it stands, and it delivers leaf lettuce to us all the way through winter. Quite amazing. Apart from this, I have, on the benching, I have Streptocarpus, a houseplant which has got beautiful different colours of flowers, sort of flat trumpet-shaped flowers, sometimes up to about something like 5 to 8 centimetres long. And they are beautiful. They're give me the spray at the present time. I've also got things like chili peppers growing in there and cucumber plant. This at the present time, it's joy to behold. The only thing I'm missing is the electric to plug in a kettle and have a cup of tea.
This is the Nature Garden Podcast with Carl Steinson, Tom Pattinson, Tom Cadwallander, and Steve Lowe.
Steve Lowe from the Northumberland Rivers Trust has been out and about at one of his pet projects looking at the historical ups and downs of the Cresswell Peel Tower and its environs. And he has news of an exciting event taking place this month.
Hi there, this is Steve Lowe again. Hi. One of my jobs, and I'm really lucky to have this one, is I'm working at Cresswell at the newly restored Peel Tower. Now, with the work there has been going on for a number of years, about 6 years in total. We've actually undertaken a number of archaeological digs. We've had the tower fully restored, so it's got a roof on. It's relatively dry, and we've cleaned it up and removed all of the scrub that was growing inside the building, etc. The good news is it's all coming to an end. And actually on the 25th of July at 11 o'clock, the tower will be open to the public. And what we hope is that people will come along and enjoy the work that's been done, that's been completed, and hopefully they'll get a lot more of the history of the site, which is absolutely fascinating. And if they're interested, then we're certainly going to be welcoming people to volunteer. It's a great site. Not only is the tower itself, which is 14th century, and we now know there was an earlier building underneath it, it was built to protect the local area from the border reavers. Well, actually, more likely to be some of the people who lived in the local area from the border reavers. We also know that there was a manor house built there later on, and that was demolished, and a new one was being built to replace it, which is now no longer there either, because that was subsiding and in danger of falling to bits. And we're trying to bring all of this information together and put some of it on display and hopefully chat with other folk about some of it. And part of the project now has moved on a step, I've got to say, is we've also acquired a large part of one of the old gardens from the hall, which is a walled garden, quite a traditional walled garden. People may well have seen some of this on BBC TV when they've been looking at the RHS we're doing a new site in Cheshire, Lancashire way. We've been working really hard to try to catch up with it, really. And the thing is, what we've done is we've had volunteers working to try and clean the borders, and we've been getting plants donated to us. And we've done all of this through lockdown, so it's been a small number of people doing it, but it's starting to look absolutely amazing. And what we're hoping is that the whole site will be available for the local community to come in, not just to enjoy, but also to participate in. So if they want to do a bit of gardening, learn a bit of gardening, use the site for other things, we're hoping we might get a... Well, the aim anyway is to get beehives in there. We're aiming also to get an orchard, that sort of stuff. And it'll be another superb little thing for people to be getting engaged with. Now, they don't have to be local. They can come from anywhere they want. And, but the main thing is, it is opening soon. It's likely that first weekend will be dead busy. As you can imagine, people will be thronging in there to have a look at it. But I would suggest that from then on we're actually open every weekend from 11 till 4 until the summer holidays, and then we're reviewing that. And I think we're likely to be open most weekends from then on, but we're not entirely sure yet. Want to see how it goes. But please come along. And if you do, tell us you've heard this on the radio, because it's always nice to know that you've got a following out there. But we look forward to seeing you, and I've got to tell you, this is a real gem of a project.
Here's Tom with some things to be getting on with in the garden.
Well, it's jobs for the week time again. Amazing how time flies when you're having fun. So, I've started saving seeds already. This is something that's advised in late summer, autumn time, and save a lot of money in the process. I do it with some vegetables, and I do it with quite a few flowers. Now, some might not reproduce true to form, some of the flowers, but I still like those flowers, plants, so I'm saving it. First, I'm starting this week with the wallflower. Outside, they've got some lovely seed pods, and they're just about ripe, and as soon as they have turned brown a little bit, some of them have, I'll pick those off. And out in another part of the garden, a moist part of the garden, I have some super cowslips. I have them planted in groups, and they have been brilliant. They were bought through the trade, of course, and at one of the outlets locally, and they've been in the garden for a few years now. They tend to sell seed themselves, and people fuss on about sowing them in seed trays, etc. Really, if you saw the seedlings that come develop near these patches that I have, you would immediately say, just collect the seed heads, which I'm doing now because they're firm and they're just turning brown. Collect those seed heads, collect the seeds, and just scatter them where you want them to develop. Simple as that. I'm also looking at some of the shrubs in outdoors that have been very attractive, the late spring, early summer shrubs, and I see one of them has finished flowering. That's Ceanothus concha. Beautiful. It was a mass of blue flowers, but it's put growths on already. And I can't let it get far too big. It's a standard, and it's got a large head on it, canopy on it already. And if I allow it to get too big and bulky, the snow will come, or wind and rain on it, and make it top heavy, and it will break. And I don't want that, so I'm stepping in now to prune it. Many of these shrubs, best time to prune them is straight after flowering, if you're in doubt. It's going to be pruned this week, coming. I'm also deadheading those ornamentals outside. We started on the Alec Garden roses, deadheading those. And it's a process that will continue way up to October anyway. And if you, the simple fact is that any flowering plant, or most flowering plants, if you remove the faded flower heads, they've got to reproduce somehow, and they need to produce more flower buds, and which pleases us, of course, to get to the seed stage. And this is the way with roses, for sure. So we're deadheading our own roses in our garden here at home as well, and all of the bedding plants out there, we're deadheading those. It keeps them going most of the time. The other thing essential at the moment is feeding. I'm feeding the tomatoes once a week. The cucumber gets food as well. It's a mini cucumber. It has so many mini cucumbers. We're about 15 centimetres long. They're and very tasty, plump little cucumbers. It's being fed. The peach and the vines are being fed. And even the containers outside, which have the ornamental plants in, the bedding plants, they are being fed. Now, fine, if you have a hanging basket, say, or a window box or something of that nature, and it has slow-release granules in the form of round pellets or something of that nature, then it will be feeding anyway. It will be releasing that feed into the system. But certainly, if you've just been relying on the original compost you planted your bedding plants into, or about 6 weeks ago, possibly the earliest, something like that, that will be running out of steam now. It needs some supplements, so that's where the feeding comes in. Either granular feed, a general feed really, possibly high in potash if it's the tomatoes, because we have the trusses set now, but a general feed, and it can be a foliar feed with the watering can or with spray. Mix it in with water, the feed, and it absorbs through the leaves. Quick way of getting it into the plant system. Everything out there, I know it's been raining, but do keep an eye on the watering, because it is nothing worse than a plant begging for water. The soil's dried out too quickly, and you'll think, you know, it just rained for 2 or 3 days. It must be wet enough out there. I'm finishing off the hedges. I'm trying to dispose of all the items that I've cut from the hedge, all those cuttings. They're going to the recycling unit because I can't deal with any more of them in my compost pile. This is so much to do this week. I'm trying to get through it all. Anyway, whatever you're doing this week, I'll leave it at that. Enjoy your gardening.
You've been listening to Gardener Tom Pattinson, Birder Tom Cadwallander from the British Trust for Ornithology, and Steve Lowe from the Northumberland Rivers Trust and Cresswell Peel Tower Project. I'm Carl Steinson, and do check out our Twitter and Facebook page, The Nature Garden, and we'll be back soon. And in the meantime, enjoy your gardening and time outdoors with nature. Bye for now.